So then what happened was lots of people started to weigh in. And Dr. Robert Moynihan, who's the editor of Inside the Vatican, then performed, I think, a great service. Now, I think Dr. Moynihan says a lot of good things. I often don't agree with him. But I met him. He's a good Catholic man. I think he's doing a lot of good work. But one thing he did was he invited a bunch of scholars to contribute to this discussion. In other words, here, we want your 2 cents worth. And I have two of them in front of me that I just read slightly before I started recording. One of them is by a very respected theologian. He's a Capuchin Franciscan. His name is Father Thomas Wynandi. I've read some of his writings before, and I appreciate a lot of his work. He has some interesting little short YouTube videos on the Fathers of the Church that are worth watching, introducing various Fathers of the Church. He's a very serious theologian who meets all the criteria, by the way, that I listed at the front as a theologian. He's a real theologian, so he's got the degrees, he's got the mandate. In fact, at one time he was an official theological advisor to the United States Council of Catholic Bishops, Conference of Catholic Bishops, but then he was asked to resign when he publicly criticized Pope Francis. He's a respected theologian, and he's also taken it on the chin to criticize people in power. He criticized Pope Francis after praying to know God's will at the tomb of St. Peter in Rome. And he received what he thought was a sign after specifically asking for a sign after praying at the tomb of St. Peter. And then he came out with a fairly blistering critique of the entire orientation of Pope Francis's pontificate in an open letter to Pope Francis. You can't say the guy's not manly. You cannot say that about him. Now, it's interesting. I strongly disagree with his comment on this, which I'm not going to attempt to read it. I'll have a link to it, but it's about 5 pages in 8.5 by 11 format, the way I printed it out here. But it's interesting. He has his own take on it, and he says about Vatican II that it's a severe grace and it's a beneficent grace. About Vatican II itself. And I found myself agreeing with the severe grace stuff to some degree. I didn't like the way he expressed the certain points, but what he's saying is that Vatican II, what's the idea of a severe grace? Well, you know, you might pray to know God's will and God makes his will manifest in your life by introducing or allowing lots of trauma, lots of contradiction, lots of suffering. And through the midst of that, you come to some important realization about yourself or about what you should do. Huh? This is what he means by a severe grace, something difficult, something harsh, something painful. Yet through it, God is bringing you up to a higher level. Huh? Sort of like in the mystics, you talk about the dark night of the soul, huh? That kind of thing. So the Second Vatican Council was in a lot of ways a severe grace in as much as it brought out to the fore a lot of the rot that was in the church. I absolutely agree with that. Now, I don't know that I would agree with Father Wynandi in every one of his applications of that, but I do agree with that. But then he talks about it being a beneficent grace, and in the beneficent grace, he says, well, certain movements that are blessing the church now wouldn't have been possible without Vatican II, and he lists the charismatic movement. Well, I think the charismatic movement is a tremendous and horrible affliction on the church, and I do think it needs to be condemned. So we obviously disagree there on what constitutes a beneficent grace. He also talks about the pontificate of John Paul II, which I don't think was a tremendous blessing on the church. He talks about his clear and lucid encyclicals, which I think if that's clear and lucid, then what do you say about Pius X's encyclicals? I mean, John Paul II's encyclicals were written in this extremely turgid existentialese that is not clear. A lot of it's not clear. Some of it was clear. I mean, some of it, like his encyclical on moral theology, condemning a lot of the errors in moral theology, Veritatis Splendor, was good and was actually not easy to read if you're not used to those kinds of texts. But if you are used to those texts, it was a good read, and it was lucid. Not so a lot of the other encyclicals of John Paul II, owing to, I think, his philosophy of Lublin existential personalism, which we have spoken of on this show before. So I don't think that was a good example of defending Vatican II. So actually, if you take Father Wynandy seriously and you see what he's saying was good about Vatican II, a lot of the good things about Vatican II are it brought to the fore a lot of the problems in the church. Well, I absolutely agree with that. But then the blessings he talks about, I don't agree with most of that. Neither the charismatic movement nor the wonders of the pontificate of John Paul II. Now, Dr. Anthony Esselin also contributed an essay, and it's interesting, in the comments, there were only three comments, I think, on the Inside the Vatican website, but they went after him viciously. Two of them went after him viciously, and one guy sort of politely attempted to defend Dr. Esselin. Dr. Esselin lives here now in New Hampshire. He was in Rhode Island before. Now he's in New Hampshire teaching at Magdalen College. But it's interesting. He's agreeing with Archbishop Vigano. Now, it's true, Dr. Esselin's not a theologian. He probably knows more theology than 98% of living Catholics, but that's neither here nor there. So do I, and I don't count as a real theologian. Okay, my little master's degree from Holy Apostles doesn't qualify me to be a theologian in the strict sense of that term. I'm not a professional theologian. Neither is Dr. Esselin. He's a professional. He's a doctor he's got a PhD, but he's a literary man. He's a literature guy, and he's translated Dante. He's no lightweight, but he's not a theologian in the precise meaning of that term. It's interesting. One of his funny things, he says, he talked about the development. He said, if there's any way of saving Vatican II, it's got to be, now I'm paraphrasing here, it's got to be interpreted with the hermeneutic of continuity. Because if you think it's if you interpret it with this hermeneutic of rupture and discontinuity that Ratzinger talked about, then you've got the church beginning in 1962. And everything that came before it was something you can toss out, right? So he's saying if it's salvageable, it's salvageable because of the hermeneutic of continuity. But then he goes on to say, marriage does not develop by divorce. If the documents of Vatican II can be brought into harmony with what the church has always taught, they must be, regardless of the intentions of the attending prelates and theologians. So he's even bringing up the possibility that the intentions of the prelates and theologians were not so good. But then he goes on. And he says, it's interesting how he brings out this historical contrast. We say with embarrassment that the Spanish Inquisition was not as bad as people think and that it should be understood in the context of the time and culture. So also Vatican II. It should be understood in the context of the time, and the time has passed. It did not affirm error. Its implementers did little good and much mischief. Enough already. The sooner we forget it, the sooner we bid it leave, and the throne. The sooner we forget it, the sooner we bid it leave the throne it never deserved. The sooner we cast off its dated liturgical innovations, as dated as Godspell and the Singing Nun, the better. Of course, Godspell was a cheesy musical that came out, in the 60s or 70s? You're listening to Reconquest and the Crusade Premium Channel, part of the Veritas Radio Network. This is Brother Andre Marie, and we're talking about a much-needed discussion on Vatican II. So Dr. Esselin weighed in and said some surprisingly traditionalist-sounding things. And I know he's not a traditionalist, liturgically speaking. I know that for a fact. He does not worship at the traditional Latin Mass. Even when he had ready access to it in nearby Nashua, New Hampshire, he didn't. But and I'm not trashing him for it. I'm just saying that's the fact. So we're not dealing with a trad here, but we are dealing with somebody with a sensus catholicus informed by his knowledge of traditional Catholic literature. So he comes at it from that perspective, but he's basically saying the sooner we forget Vatican II, the better. And he's also pointing out something that many, 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 many commentators have said about Vatican II. It is extremely time-bound. When you read some of the language of Vatican II, and if you don't know what I'm talking about, do yourself a profound service and open up the text on social communications in Vatican II. And you will be mystified at how bishops could have written a text like that. But you will also say to yourself, wow, this is so passé. This is so expired. It's so irrelevant now. In a way that I don't think any previous magisterial text could be irrelevant, except perhaps something that's saying that, you know, that Jews should wear badges demarcating the fact that they are Jews, so everybody knows that. Yeah, we might not need that in modern-day Boston or something, right? So, although many Jews, of course, if they're Orthodox, voluntarily make themselves visible. But yeah, there was at least one council of the church that did that. And of course, St. Thomas Aquinas himself said that that should be done. But I would argue that a lot of what's in Vatican II is even more time-bound than that. We're talking page after page after page after page.